Revolution Health Radio Show. I'm Steve Wright from SCDLifestyle.com, and with me is Chris Kresser, health detective and creator of ChrisKresser.com. How's it going today, Chris?
Well, to be honest, I'm a little bit sick. The first time in a long time. And this will be a good segue into one of the papers we're going to talk about, which is the effect of stress on the immune system. But Sylvie's been teething. She started teething pretty early. You know, she's only 4 months old, and but she's starting to get a tooth. And for those of you who have kids, you probably know what that means. I'm not sleeping very much. She's just really kind of out of sorts during the night. And then my family was up visiting. And I have like six nieces and nephews, and three or four of them were sick. So both Sylvie and I got sick because I've been really run down, not sleeping. And so I'm a good case study for this stress paper we're going to talk about. Steve, why don't you introduce yourself? Tell everyone, you know, where you're coming from, how you came to be here on this show, and just let everyone get to know you a little bit.
First off, I want to thank you, Chris, for allowing me to have this chance to be your host. I think it's going to be a great friendship that we're going to build here and a great show. A little background on me. My friend Jordan and I, we run a blog, scdlifestyle.com, and the blog is dedicated to digestive problems and people who suffer with them, everything from bowel disorders, IBS, celiac disease, all those types of things. Jordan had celiac disease, and I used to have IBS, and we used a specific carbohydrate diet and supplements to really turn our lives around and our health around. And we just feel really passionate about this subject and helping people, and so we went ahead and we created an ebook about how we did it and how people like us could turn their health around as fast as possible using the specific carbohydrate diet.
Right, maybe I'll jump in and say, for those of you who actually, one of my patients the other day complained to me that we throw all these acronyms around and talk about these diets, and some people, we just kind of assume that everyone knows what they are, and a lot of people do. But for those of you who don't know, some of you might be familiar with the GAPS diet, and the GAPS diet is very similar to the specific carbohydrate diet, but they're like paleo, but they completely remove starches, so you wouldn't eat sweet potatoes or plantains or things like that, and there's more of an emphasis on fermented foods and bone broth, particularly in the GAPS diet. So how long have you been doing that for, Steve?
I started in January of 2010, and previous to that, I'd been sick for 5 or 6 years. Mm-hmm. So since then, like you said, the GAPS diet and the SCD diet are very similar. And Jordan and I have found out that along with paleo and the starches that, like you prescribe to, that there's no one diet for all. And so our take on the SCD diet really goes to the next level, we think, where we embrace the different things that the GAPS people have an emphasis on, as well as some things like we're not poo-pooing, no pun intended, starches or anything like that, but mm-hmm. that we take the opinion that everyone needs to find their own diet. They need to test all foods, and that everything should be subject to a test.
Yeah, great. So we're glad to have you, Steve. And Jordan is our behind-the-scenes genius, helping with produce the show and make sure everything's running smoothly. And so I'm really glad to have you both on my team. So why don't we dive in? We got some interesting stuff to talk about today. Actually, one of the studies we're going to cover is related to the gut. As most of my listeners know, it's one of my favorite subjects too. So I'm going to talk about the stress paper that I mentioned, especially because it's front and center on my mind right now, the connection between stress and the immune system. And then we'll talk about the new leaky gut paper by Alessio Fasano, who's one of my favorite researchers and a real pioneer in the field of intestinal permeability and autoimmune disease research. And if we have any time after that, we'll get to some questions. I know I did a Facebook post soliciting questions, but I decided that I really want to talk about these two studies. And if we don't get to some of the questions, we'll get to them on a future episode. Sound good?
Sounds great, man. I can't wait to hear what you think about these studies.
All right, so let's talk about this paper. The title is Chronic Stress, Immune Dysregulation, and Health. I can't remember where I came across it. Somebody sent it to me. It's all kind of last week. It's all kind of a blur. But let's start with the definition of stress. That's actually the very first line of this paper, and I really like their definition of stress. I think it will help people understand what I mean when I talk about stress, because I've mentioned this several times on my blog and the 9 Steps to Perfect Health series on the podcast. I really try to encourage people to take a broader view of what stress is, because most people hear stress and they think of psychological and emotional stress, like financial problems or problems in a relationship or anything like that. And of course, that is stress, but stress is actually much more inclusive. The definition these researchers used was stress occurs when environmental demands exceed the individual's capacity to cope. So from that perspective, anything that throws the body out of its natural balance, or homeostasis being the more technical term, is a stressor. So an injury could be stress. A chronic gut infection could be stress. Overtraining, especially the wrong kind of training, can be a stressor on the body, which means that you could have no cares. You could be independently wealthy and living, laying on a beach in Thailand, with absolutely no psychological or emotional stress whatsoever. But if you have a gut infection, you're under stress. And I think that's really important to understand when we talk about addressing stress. The other thing is, when you look at it from this perspective, there's two different types of stress. One is called eustress, and the other is called distress. And eustress is the kind of stress that is actually beneficial, which is the stress that encourages an adaptive response. So an example of that would be exercise, if it's done, properly. Like if you go and you lift weights, that weightlifting tears down your muscles. But when your muscles grow back, they grow back a little bit bigger so that they can handle the next challenge, and that's an adaptive evolutionary mechanism. So that kind of stress can be beneficial because it helps us to grow and expand our capacities. Distress is often chronic stress, and this is the type of stress that directly affects our immune function via neuroendocrine and sympathetic pathways. And over time, consistent activation of those systems can cause a wear and tear on the body that researchers refer to as allostatic load. So, often mild acute stress, especially when it's adaptive, like it with exercise, is beneficial, but it's that chronic stress that can be so harmful to the body. And in the paper, they review a number of impacts of chronic stress, but one of the main impacts is inflammation. And that's something, of course, we talk about a lot as well. But studies have shown that even acute psychological stress can reliably increase interleukin-6 levels. That's a type of inflammatory cytokine, and C-reactive protein, which is an acute phase reactant, the type of protein that's elevated in the inflammatory response. And it's pretty well known and pretty well established in the literature now that chronic stress is associated with chronic low-grade inflammation. And that's the type of inflammation that's associated with nearly every modern disease, like cancer, cardiovascular disease, diabetes, autoimmunity, obesity, etc. And one of the best models for studying this, one of the most frequently used models in the literature, is they look at caregivers, people who are taking care of a partner who have Alzheimer's or dementia or another degenerative disease, because it's just so stressful. And when they study the caregiving population, they find that they have often double or even triple the risk of mortality than age-matched non-caregivers. And that's And you know, they'll study circulating inflammatory markers and find that they're higher. Their CRP is often higher. And this is just more evidence of the toll that chronic stress takes on the body. There was an interesting section of the paper where they were talking about how conflict and even, you know, arguing with your spouse or partner can wreak havoc on your immune system. And there was a study on couples who engaged in frequent hostile negative interactions, that's the way they put it, that had, and they, these couples had much higher levels of interleukin 6, that inflammatory cytokine, than less hostile couples. And then another study showed that people with a high frequency of interpersonal conflict in their daily life had higher levels of interleukin 6 and higher levels of CRP. So, you know, the lesson there, of course, is that be nice to your partner. You know, the interpersonal conflict, which, you know, can affect us emotionally, is affecting us physiologically. And most people know this already intuitively, right? I mean, it doesn't feel good in your body when you're angry or really upset, but I think it's helpful to have the mechanisms pointed out, where people can make a concrete connection between emotional and psychological stress and real physiological mechanisms that are affected by that. And that was kind of the point of this paper. Because a lot of times when I talk to people about stress, I think what happens, everyone has kind of an idea and a real direct experience that stress causes physiological problems. You know, even just on a simple level, if someone has a fear of public speaking, or even if they don't, and they have to, you know, get out in front of a group of people, they're gonna probably notice some kind of fluttering in their belly. You know, some people actually experience pretty severe gastrointestinal symptoms if they have to speak publicly. There's a really strong, clear connection, so people aren't really surprised by this. But I think now that we understand, have a better understanding of the actual mechanisms involved, and people can really understand what those mechanisms are. I mean, personally, I've found that that's helped me to take stress more seriously and to really pay attention to it and really elevate it, you know, to the same level as and sometimes in some cases even higher than nutrition and a lot of the other things that we talk about. Because it's really difficult in the modern world to work with it, and it's a lot easier to change the diet and to take supplements, I think, for most people than it is to really address these the stress mechanisms. So there was a couple of interesting things about this paper. We've talked previously on the show, I think, about the when we did the Gut Brain Axis podcast, about the connection between depression and or chronic inflammation and depression. And in fact, some researchers now think, you know, that there's a model of depression, of studying depression, called the inflammatory cytokine model of depression. And some researchers really believe that depression is primarily mediated by inflammation. But this paper was saying that there's also evidence that it works the other way around, that depression can cause chronic inflammation, which in turn leads to immune dysregulation. And the evidence for that is that among clinically depressed patients, treatment leads to a reduction of circulating inflammatory markers. And then initial levels of depression, like when they do prospective studies of people with depression, people who start out in those studies depressed end up having higher levels of circulating inflammatory markers. And, you know, prospective studies are observational in nature and they can't really prove anything, but it's an interesting correlation. And when you put it together with the fact that treating depression reduces inflammatory markers, there's quite a lot of evidence to support that connection. And then the last thing I want to talk about in this paper is that, Most of you know, I think, that cortisol is one of the main anti-inflammatory hormones in the body. So when we, it's part of the fight or flight, the stress response. When we're under stress, the body makes cortisol, and cortisol suppresses inflammation. That's how it's supposed to work, at least. But studies have shown recently that persistent exposure to high levels of cortisol during chronic stress actually downregulates cortisol receptors on cells. So this leads to cortisol resistance, where the immune cells become non-responsive to the anti-inflammatory effects of cortisol. So in a way, this is just like insulin resistance, only it's working with cortisol. So the takeaway is that when somebody's under chronic stress, they're almost certainly going to be chronically inflamed. And if someone is chronically inflamed, they're almost certainly going to have a poorly functioning immune system. And that can manifest as increased susceptibility to infectious disease, like colds and flus. Case in point for me this week. Or it could manifest as autoimmunity, which we're, of course, seeing a huge rise in over the past couple of decades. And there are a lot of reasons for that. I think nutrition is certainly plays a strong role, but we'd be kidding ourselves if we didn't acknowledge the role that I think increasing stress of modern life plays in the rising incidence of autoimmune disease.
So, Chris, I'm guessing as someone who wants to try to maximize their health, you wouldn't want us to be rushing out and getting our IL-6 and our CRP tested. We should just assume then, based on this paper, that we all have some stress if we're living in the modern world, that we should probably be taking some steps.
Maybe you're hearing the Sylvie sound effects in the background there. She's having a rough morning with this tooth, the tooth coming in. I think I don't. I mean, getting CRP measured can be useful. IL-6 is not very often tested in a clinical setting. You might have a hard time getting your doctor to order it, but CRP can be useful. Just if anything else, is a benchmark, to see where you're at. But if you're under chronic stress, you can pretty much assume that you're dealing with some inflammation, and for all the reasons that I just mentioned, I don't think it's necessary to get a test to confirm that. And yeah, I think it's just a question of taking some steps to reduce the amount of stress that you have in your life, if possible. It's not always possible, but there are some things you can do. Even if you can't really change the circumstances of your life, you can change the way you relate to those circumstances, and that has a net effect of reducing stress. And then you can also do things to increase your stress tolerance so that the stress that you are experiencing in your life doesn't impact your body in the same way. And I outlined several of these things in the article on managing stress in the 9 Steps to Perfect Health series. So if you go to chriskresser.com/perfect health, there's an index of all of those articles. And it's the one titled Manage Your Stress. And there's several recommendations in that article for some of the things that you can do. But interestingly enough, one of the most negative impacts of chronic stress, and this is in the literature as well, is that people who are under chronic stress will tend to adopt behaviors that can be damaging to their health, or discontinue behaviors that could have protective health effects. So it's one of those sort of chicken and egg things, or vicious cycles, really, where someone who's really stressed out says, "I'm too stressed out to do stress reduction," or I'm sure we've all had the experience, if we're like really, really stressed or really upset, we might have craving for food that we wouldn't normally eat, or our diet kind of falls apart, or whatever. But that's another reason why taking specific steps to manage that stress can be helpful, because it puts us back in a kind of upward spiral instead of the downward spiral that chronic stress can often involve. So I think that's it. Unless there's anything else that you wanted to say about that, see you.
No, I would say that I know from personal experience that if I spend too long outside of the gym, that I can almost feel the anxiety kind of creep back into my life, and that I've also tried your recommendations, and I really like the rest and digest program. I use some of those exercises on like a daily basis, like, 5 minutes here or there during the day, and that seems to really help, so.
Yeah, I like that too. I think you're referring to the Rest Assured program, right?
Oh yeah, the Rest Assured program.
Yeah, Rest and Digest might be a better name though. I like it. Yeah, so the Rest Assured program, you can get it at soundersleep.com. You can download the MP3s, and it is really helpful. And one of the things I like about it in particular is that, like you said, there are some techniques that can be done in as little as 4 or 5 minutes throughout the day, and it can really just help keep the edge off. Even if you're busy, most people can find, a few minutes during the day to do that.
4 or 5 minutes, I only do it for two and I feel
Yeah, so there you
it.
go. There you go. Well, cool. Let's dive into the Fasano paper. He, like I said, he's really one of my favorite researchers. I read everything. I've read, I think, everything that he's published, and I was really excited to see a new paper come out. It just came out, I don't know, 23rd of November, I think. It's called Leaky Gut and Autoimmune Diseases, and it was the Clinical Review of Allergy and Immunology. I just posted a link to it on Twitter, twitter.com/ChrisKresser, this morning. Because I tweeted about it yesterday. But as I said before, Fasano is a bit of a pioneer in the field of leaky gut and autoimmune disease. He's the one who's really established, in the scientific literature at least, this connection between leaky gut and autoimmunity. And we're going to talk about this more in more detail, but I also wrote about this in my series on diabesity and the connection between the gut and diabetes and obesity. But his view is actually that you can't even develop autoimmune disease without a leaky gut. And I'll explain more about that in a second. But first, I want to talk about some of the more conventional theories about autoimmunity, or maybe I should say more traditional or recent views on autoimmunity, because I don't know that they're exactly conventional. But early on, after autoimmune disease was discovered, most people thought that they were associated with viral and bacterial infections. And in fact, there is a school of thought still today that believes that there is no such thing as autoimmunity, and that all autoimmune diseases are actually infectious disease and infections that we may not be able to detect with our methods of testing at this point. Yeah, so there's a whole group of people who believe that autoimmune disease doesn't exist, and that all autoimmune diseases are actually infectious diseases, and they may be infections that we can't detect with our current method of testing. I think there's a biologist, microbiologist named Paul Ewald. I might be getting his first name wrong. But I think that's what he believes, and there are a number of different groups that believe that. But the connection between a non-self antigen like bacteria or virus and autoimmune disease is often explained by a mechanism called molecular mimicry, and it works like this: a microbial like virus or bacteria or a food antigen like gluten enters the body. And then the immune system mounts an attack against it and produce antibodies. But since the chemical structure of those non-self antigens can be similar to proteins found in various tissues in the body, you get a cross reaction where, as the body is attacking those non-self antigens, it also starts attacking itself. And it can attack the thyroid, like in Hashimoto's or Graves, or it can attack the joints and rheumatoid arthritis, or the myelin sheath and multiple sclerosis, or the gut in inflammatory bowel disease. And animal studies have confirmed that molecular mimicry is part of the autoimmune process. But here's the interesting thing: in human studies, it appears that molecular mimicry might be the effect rather than the cause of autoimmunity. So, in other words, That molecular mimicry process that I just described is only a factor in the progression of pre-existing autoimmune diseases. So that's one theory, the molecular mimicry theory. And that's, I would say that's probably one of the most popular theory at this point. Another theory of autoimmunity is called the bystander effect. And this is similar to molecular mimicry. But in this model, those non-self antigens like bacteria or viruses directly damage the tissue in the body, and then they expose parts of the tissue that shouldn't otherwise be exposed, and then the body attacks those parts of itself, of the tissue, as if they were not self. So I think the important thing to understand about both of those theories, the bystander effect and the molecular mimicry, is that the idea is even if you remove the trigger, which could be a bacteria or a virus or gluten, according to those theories, the autoimmune process will continue because the antibodies have already been produced and the body's already started attacking its own tissue. And because of the way the immune system works, once the body starts producing antibodies, then it won't ever stop. And that benefits us because, for the most part, like if you get exposed to chickenpox when you're a kid and then you get exposed to that virus again later in life, you're not going to get it. And that could, there could be 30, 40, 50 years that pass, but the body always remembers. But according to the molecular mimicry model, that backfires on us when we're dealing with this autoimmune process. But Fasano is proposing an entirely different theory of autoimmunity that involves leaky gut as the crucial element. And he says that three preconditions have to be present for autoimmunity to develop. And I covered these again in that article on the gut, the connection between the gut and diabesity. Number one is that you have to have a genetic predisposition to autoimmunity. So some people have asked me, you know, well, why my friend eats, you know, a really crappy diet, even worse than I ever ate, and doesn't really exercise and is really stressed, and he doesn't have autoimmune disease, but I have three autoimmune diseases. You know, what's that about? And that's probably about genetics. There is a genetic predisposition to almost every autoimmune disease that's been studied. Number two, there has to be an environmental trigger. So even if you have the genes, the genetic predisposition to autoimmune disease, without an environmental trigger, it won't get activated. And that's, you know, that can explain why, even though our genes haven't changed that much in the last 100 years, very little, if any, there's been this, you know, explosion of autoimmune disease. That's because even though the genes haven't changed that much, the environment has changed quite a lot. And the environmental triggers now are happening all around us, in both in food and then in air and water, biochemical toxins. And those are triggering these genetic tendencies in a way that didn't happen 150 years ago. And then number three, and maybe most important in Fasano's model, is that you have to have a permeable intestine or a leaky gut, or more specifically, abnormal function of the tight junctions. So the tight junctions are TJs, as they're called. If you take your hands and you interlace your fingers, that's kind of what the tight junctions look like. I mean, on a much smaller level. And if you open and close your hands so that you can create a little bit of space between your interlaced fingers, and then you close it so that there's no space and nothing can get through, that's kind of how the tight junctions are supposed to work. They selectively allow molecules to pass into the bloodstream that should be in the bloodstream, like nutrients that we need, and then they are supposed to selectively prevent things from entering the bloodstream that we don't want in our body, like antigens, pathogens, or large molecules that would provoke an immune response. But what happens with leaky gut is that those tight junctions stop being able to make that distinction, or and they just permanently become a little bit open, so things start passing through the gut like a sieve. And that's a big problem, because one of, you know, the main purpose of the gut is to serve as a barrier that keeps things outside of the body that shouldn't be in the body, and lets things in that should be in. So Fasano introduced this trinity a while back, and a lot of research supports it. We know that celiac disease and type 1 diabetes, MS, rheumatoid arthritis, Crohn's, and several other autoimmune diseases have all been associated with leaky gut that allows the passage of these antigens from the intestinal flora into the bloodstream. And this then challenges the immune system to produce a response that can target any organ or tissue in people that are genetically predisposed. So the significance of this is pretty huge, because if it turns out to be right, it implies that, contrary to those popular theories of autoimmune disease like molecular mimicry and bystander effect, that the autoimmune response can theoretically be stopped and then even reversed if the interplay between genes and environmental triggers is eliminated. So let me use an example to explain what I mean. Celiac disease is actually a perfect example of this, because we know that what the genetic factors are, the HLA-DQ genotype. We know what the environmental trigger is, which is gluten and its many subfractions. And then we know that that celiac is characterized by a leaky gut. So I just mentioned gluten and its subfractions. I want to take a little side tangent for a second and talk about that. One of the sections in the paper that really stood out to me, and I talked about this in my first article in the Nine Steps to Perfect Health series, Don't Eat Toxins. But, you know, it used to be thought that it was just pretty much gluten that caused problems. And now we know that the repertoire of gluten peptides that are involved in disease is a lot bigger than we previously thought. And in this latest paper, Fasano says there are at least 50 different toxic epitopes in gluten peptides that have been shown to destroy cells, dysregulate the immune system, and cause leaky gut. So, and when we're talking about the proteins in wheat, we can talk about gluten, gliadin, deamidated gliadin, and then even with gliadin, there's different epitopes like alpha, beta, gamma, and then we have wheat germ agglutinin or WGA. There's just a number of proteins that can cause problems, like destroying cells and destroying tissue in the gut. So back to what we were talking about before, zonulin is a protein that was recently discovered that regulates the tight junctions. And Fasano's talked a lot about this in his research. And we know that zonulin is overexpressed in people with autoimmune diseases like celiac. So the more zonulin they have, the more leaky their gut is. So it basically works like this. If someone with celiac eats gluten or gluten intolerance, and then they get an increase in zonulin production, and then that increases inflammation, inflammatory cytokine production, and then tight junctions in the gut open, you know, like those interlaced fingers open, and allow a passage of antigens from the gut into the blood, and then the body mounts an immune response, and then you get inflammation in the gut and everywhere else. But as Fasano explained, this process can be completely reversed in people with celiac if you remove gluten from the diet. So when you take out the environmental trigger, which is gluten, you see a decrease in zonulin levels. You see that the intestinal barrier function, you know, which is supposed to keep things out and let the right things in, is restored. Antibodies drop, and then the whole autoimmune process shuts off. And then even after that, the intestinal damage, if you take away gluten for long enough, repairs itself completely. So, I mean, it's kind of leads to the question, is this a cure? Does this mean that autoimmune disease can be cured? I guess the answer to that depends on what you mean by cure. It doesn't mean that a person with celiac can go eat, you know, a pizza and get away with it. But it does mean that they can live a normal, healthy life if they alter that interplay of genes and environmental triggers. Unfortunately, in the case of other autoimmune diseases, the trigger isn't quite as clear. I mean, we know that gluten can exacerbate and even trigger other autoimmune diseases by making the gut permeable. And in that framework that we're talking about, if you have a genetic predisposition, environmental trigger like gluten, and then leaky gut, you can develop autoimmune disease, and not just celiac, a bunch of the other ones that I mentioned. But what I can say, you know, in my practice and my experience working with patients is that removing gluten often helps, but it doesn't always completely resolve the condition as it would in celiac, you know, where you see that decrease in antibodies and repair of tissue and everything else. And in some cases, like in Crohn's, the trigger is not something that can just be easily removed, because the trigger in Crohn's is thought by a lot of people to be the commensal gut flora or the normal gut flora. And the body is essentially mounting an autoimmune response to its own gut flora. And it's pretty hard to remove that, since it's a normal part of the body. You can't really fully sterilize your gut unless you live on antibiotics, and there's obviously a lot of reasons not to do that. But one interesting thing in this paper, and I'm always naturally skeptical of drugs until I really see research that shows that they're safe, because do no harm is always the first principle of medicine, even though that's often forgotten. But there's a drug that they're trialing right now. It's in phase 2 clinical trials. It's called lorazepam, and this is a zonulin inhibitor. So, zonulin, as I mentioned, is the protein that, or the substance that interferes with tight junction function. So, lorazepam, they've done a proof of concept inpatient study. It was double blind, placebo controlled. They took two groups of patients with celiac, and they gave them gluten. I mean, I'm wondering who signed up for this study. Like, I have a lot of celiacs, and when they eat gluten, it's painful to watch what happened, and then the reaction can go on for a long time. So bravo to whoever signed up for this in the name of science, or maybe they gave them, you know, a good financial reward or something. But they took these two groups, and they gave them gluten, and one group was on a placebo and the other group was given lorazepam. And in the control group, as you'd expect, there was a 70% increase in intestinal permeability with the exposure to gluten. So no big surprise there, right? You give a celiac gluten and they get a leaky gut. But the big surprise was that in the lorazepam group, there was absolutely no change at all in intestinal permeability. So they fed these celiacs gluten, and the people that were taking lorazepam did not develop leaky gut. And furthermore, they although they had some GI symptoms from eating the gluten, they were a lot less than the control group that was taking placebo. So, you know, my philosophy on medicine is whatever works and causes the least harm. And in most cases, that's not a drug, but in some cases, like low dose naltrexone, which I've talked about a lot, and thyroid hormone medication, that can sometimes be, a drug, and perhaps lorazepam will be that for autoimmune disease. I don't know. It's certainly worth following, and I'll be following it, over the next couple of years. I don't think it will be, if they're only in phase 2 trials, it's probably going to be a few years before that medication would make it to the market. And there's been a lot of drugs that have never made it out of phase 2 or phase 3 trials because of unanticipated side effects. So, because you're messing, you know, with function of the body that we don't completely understand. We still don't really fully understand zonulin and what it does and how it does what it does. So it's still to me a little bit scary to be, you know, taking a drug that inhibits zonulin production without fully understanding that. But I will mention that in this study, there were no adverse effects compared to placebo in the lorazepam group. So it seems to be well tolerated, at least in this very small study. It was a, you know, I think, what was the sample size? I don't remember the exact sample size, but it was small. I think 14 patients or something like that. So we definitely would need to see a bigger study that was powered to, you know, to better detect whether there would be adverse effects versus placebo, and whether the drug effect was real or just a consequence of chance.
That's really encouraging. I just feel bad for the people who are going to be involved in the next phase of the, you know, 200, 300 people that are on the placebo.
Right. I mean, it certainly does present an ethical problem. I mean, it's not as serious as some of the other studies that were done in the past, you know, and even recently where you had studies continuing where, you know, part of the drug treatment arm is, you know, they're dying at a much faster rate. But yeah, that's some serious discomfort. I don't have celiac, but I have a lot of patients that do. And I guess you would know, Steve, that that's not fun, huh?
Yeah, from the people I've talked to, you'd have a hard time signing up anybody who's living a symptom-free life to try that study. So
yeah, so I guess there are people that probably haven't found the GAPS diet or the specific carbohydrate diet, and they're probably pretty desperate. But
do we know anything yet as far as what increases or decreases zonulin, like stress or supplements or anything?
Gluten certainly increases it, but no, I mean, that's not that I know of, at least. And I think probably inflammation is likely to do it. I mean, we know that inflammation contributes to a leaky gut, and that chronic stress contributes to a leaky gut. And we know that zonulin mediates the tight junction function. So we could surmise that chronic stress and inflammation probably have an effect on zonulin, which in turn causes the intestinal permeability. But I'm not aware of any papers that have directly studied that. Nor do I know about any supplements that have an effect on zonulin one way or the other. But interesting, you know, line of thinking. I have to look into the lorazepam and what exactly it is and what it does, and it would be interesting to think about other ways of accomplishing the same thing without using a drug. But certainly just going the basics that we always talk about are the starting place, you know, take out the toxins from your diet, eat nutrient dense food, manage your stress, you know, make sure you're doing all the things you need to do for a healthy gut, like eating fermented food and possibly taking probiotics if you need to, and then making sure you're getting enough sleep and you're exercising and you're having a good time in your life. That's always a starting place, you know, and this stuff we're talking about here is for the people who've already done all that stuff and they're still struggling. And that's, I mean, the same is true for low dose naltrexone when we talk about that. I never suggest that someone just goes right to low dose naltrexone and without doing all the other stuff that we've been talking about first. So I think that's it. It didn't take quite as long as I thought, so we may have time for a couple of questions.
Well, I'm looking at a question here that I think might really follow up those studies well and give you a chance to talk for a little bit longer if you want to roll into one of those.
Yeah, let's dive in.
Okay, this one comes from Lana from Facebook, and it's, how can one overcome IgG allergies, for example, eggs and milk? Thank you.
Yeah, I think this is related for sure. First of all, I think a lot of people who have been listening to this show for a while know what my opinion is about IgG food allergy testing. I think it's not ready for prime time. It's been shown in experimental, you know, experiments, like my colleagues and I drawing our blood, labeling two different vials with two different bogus names and sending them to the same lab and getting completely different results you look in the scientific literature, there's not really any support for IgG food allergy testing. However, if you have an IgG food allergy test and it says you're allergic to eggs and you eat eggs and you feel horrible, well, that's, you know, I'm not gonna debate that, but that's, I'm more paying attention to the symptom that you have when you eat eggs. So, but let's just assume that someone has, let me step back again. I assume by IgG allergy, they mean intolerance, because if it's a true allergy where you eat eggs and you have an immediate hypersensitivity reaction or anaphylaxis or something like that, or the type of allergy that you can have to shellfish or peanuts or strawberries, you know, certain people, I'm not sure that there's that much that can be done about that. If we're talking about food intolerances, then, you know, where you eat eggs and you feel bad, but you're not like headed to the hospital, you know, with your life at stake, then I think this really falls into what we've been talking about all along. I think most food sensitivities are caused by leaky gut. And that's why I'm always a fan and advocate of healing the gut, and instead of, you know, continually removing more and more foods from your diet until there's nothing left to eat, because that's just dealing with the symptom. The symptom is the intolerance to these particular foods, but the cause is the leaky gut or the gut dysbiosis or gut infection or some combination of all three of those, which is usually the case. So milk is a little... It's a little more complicated, because are we talking about pasteurized milk or raw milk? Are we talking about actual milk? Are we talking about fermented dairy? Are we talking about full fat dairy like cream or butter or ghee? You know, as I talk about in the personal paleo code, there's a really, really big difference in all of those dairy products. And if someone is sensitive to dairy, you have to ask, are they sensitive to the casein, which is the protein, or are they sensitive to the lactose, which is the sugar, or are they sensitive to both? If they're only sensitive to the lactose, then they should be able to tolerate dairy products that have very little lactose. Like ghee has no detectable lactose. Butter has very, very little lactose. And if the ratio of fat to protein and sugar and butter is like 80-1. And then if you do homemade fermented dairy, like they recommend in the specific carbohydrate diet and in GAPS, or you ferment your own yogurt for 24 hours, you can pretty much get rid of the lactose in it. If you make kefir at home, you ferment it for long enough, you can get rid of the lactose almost entirely. So even people who are lactose intolerant can often deal with long fermented dairy and some of the full fat dairy products. If someone is sensitive to casein, the casein protein, then they're going to have problems with nearly all dairy except for maybe ghee, because ghee, in theory, doesn't have much detectable casein either. And whether somebody can overcome that or not, I would say that depends. Some of the most recent research about the effect of probiotics suggests that their real benefit doesn't come from restoring or repleting the number of probiotic organisms in our gut, because really most orally consumed probiotics are only putting a tiny little dent in the total number of probiotic organisms that we have in our gut. But the recent thinking is that the probiotics are modulating the microbiota, the intestinal flora, and they actually change the milieu in such a way that we can begin to digest foods better, and we can even begin to digest certain foods that we haven't been able to digest before. And that explains why, and our gut flora is somewhat adaptive. And like, for example, we know that people who live in coastal areas of Japan, they have different gut flora than people who live maybe in the mountains in Europe. And they have different gut flora because they eat different foods and they require different bacteria to break down those foods. So, for example, there's a type of bacteria that's really helpful in breaking down the nutrients in seaweeds that the people in coastal Japan eat a lot. So they're bound to have a lot more of that bacteria. And maybe if you took someone who was living in the mountains in Europe and and they went to coastal Japan and tried to eat that much seaweed, they wouldn't be adapted to eat it. They wouldn't be able to process it as well as someone who has that genotype, or that in this case the intestinal microbiota to handle that. Art Ayers, who writes a blog called Cooling Inflammation, has posted some interesting research in the past and theorized that some people who eat some fermented dairy can cure themselves of lactose intolerance over time because they can change the gut flora in such a way that they become able to process fermented dairy or even just dairy in general. But I don't know if that works the same way with casein. Most people that in my practice who are casein intolerant pretty much stay casein intolerant. Maybe other people have had other experiences, but that's just been my experience so far.
I know that I used to have a big problem with, cause I tried making the, SCD yogurt, the 24-hour fermented yogurt when I first started the diet, and I did it with goats mm-hmm. and cows, and neither of those were raw milk. They were just store-bought organic stuff. Mm-hmm. And, it took me a really long time. I had this post nasal drip for a really long time. And, it wasn't until I seen a allergy specialist who was like, have you ever tried just not doing any dairy for 7 days or something like that? And so mm-hmm. it turned out that's what it was. And, so doing that, and then I did have a candida infection that I got rid of. But after that, I'm able to eat dairy again, including, even the crappy kind, not the raw stuff. So.
Right. Yeah. So, I mean, it's hard to say what you're reacting to at that point, but I definitely think that that's possible. And I think that that's probably mediated to some extent by the way that the bacteria in the dairy are modulating your own intestinal microbiota. And I do see that a lot, that's true in my experience too. When I first started the GAPS diet way back, I'm not doing it anymore, but this was during my more therapeutic phase. I could only tolerate like a half a teaspoon of kefir, that, and I would notice it. I would really feel it, and then it was a teaspoon, and now I could drink 2 pints of it and feel great and not notice any negative effect at all. So there's definitely some change that happens in the gut with that. But usually you have to go really start really with a very small dose and try and proceed really, really slowly over time. And it's still optional. I mean, it's only if you want to eat dairy. I think it's a healthy food when it's well tolerated and it's got a lot of fat soluble vitamins and things that can be hard to come by otherwise, but there's certainly no rule that you have to eat dairy. If you're happy without eating dairy, then, proceed. Yeah, I think we'll stop there. There's several more questions, but, I'm going to give my voice a little bit of a break this week and, we can come back to these questions in another episode.
Okay, well, that brings us to the end of this week's show, Chris. Do you want to tell us a little bit more about the Personal Paleo Code launch and how that's been received?
Oh, yeah, sure. So I finally got that out, and let's see, it was a couple weeks ago now. Personal Paleo Code, for those of you who don't know about it, is a program designed to help you discover your own ideal diet instead of following a canned approach, that's just designed for everybody. And it was born out of my experience working with patients, most of whom were totally confused about diet. And even within the context of the paleo community, there's a lot of disagreement. I don't think they're big disagreements, but, Rob Wolf might say this and I might say that, and Mark Sisson says that. And, you know, somebody else says a different thing. And the whole premise of the Paleo Code is just to stop listening to all of us and follow this three-step process that I use with my patients in my practice to figure out what works for you and your body once and for all. So you don't have to spend your evenings on paleo hacks trying to figure it out anymore. So that you can go to personalpaleocode.com. It's been really well received. I had a lot of great feedback, which of course feels good because I worked really hard on it. The meal plan generator in particular has been really popular. That's a web app that allows you to generate highly customized meal plans using only the ingredients that you want. So for example, if you're on the GAPS diet, you can just hit a button and it will bring back only GAPS recipes. Or if you're on autoimmune paleo diet, you can exclude nightshades and dairy and eggs and get a meal plan that only, you know, has recipes that don't contain those ingredients. It's been a lot of fun. And yeah, if you're interested, go check it out, personalpaleocode.com.
All right. Well, I want to thank everyone for listening this week. Keep sending us your questions at chriscresser.com, and you can use the podcast submission link to do that. If you enjoyed listening to the show, head over to iTunes and leave us a review.